Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dark Enough to See the Stars by Beth Duke, narrated by Amy McFadden. Part 1. 1. Ronnie. Fairfield Springs Nursing Home, Anniston, Alabama, February 2020.
You're the girl who wrote that book.
Mrs. Neely stared at her pale parchment arm, where I was desperately seeking a vein to insert her IV. Yes, ma'am, I am. But now I work here. I've been a registered nurse since last year. Not an author.
You know what you should write a book about?
I groaned inwardly as I found a home for the needle. This was going to hurt me more than it hurt her. No, Mrs. Neely. What should I write about? She laughed softly.
My grandma and grandpa each had a big gold tooth in front of their smiles. When Pawpaw was a younger man, a mean old dog bit off his wedding ring finger. Just bit it clean off. Course he shot that dog, but he couldn't wear his ring after that.
I nodded, wondering how she thought this would make a book. It was the 10th idea I'd heard this month.
But my meemaw, she had her wedding ring melted down and made into a gold tooth and got the dentist to surprise Pawpaw with one for his mouth, too.
Romantic, huh? Ever heard of such a thing? I have not, Mrs. McNeely. I put a bandage over her IV and stepped back. That's a first for me. I laughed. Maybe instead of betrothed, they were betoothed.
She cackled and patted her arm. You did a good job. Hardly felt this.
Her bright blue eyes followed me out of the room. I stopped at the door and said, You rest now. We need to hydrate you. You'll feel much, much better in an hour. You were trying to turn into a raisin on us.
I love you, honey, she said.
I love you too, Mrs. Neely.
You think about writing that book, okay?
Yes, ma'am. I wheeled my cushy desk chair into place and glanced at my computer, then the framed photo sitting next to it. Rick and I were bathed in red light, my co-workers never tired of asking if we were in an exciting part of Amsterdam. His arms wrapped around my waist, my head resting on his shoulder. He was sporting a camo baseball cap over his freshly shorn hair. I was mad at the military buzz cut he'd gotten before coming home one Friday to announce I needed to pack a bag for a surprise trip. Of course, I asked where we were going. Anyone else might have been more forthcoming, but Rick told me only, Bring some shorts, a nice dress, and one outfit with long sleeves, jeans, and your running shoes. I stared at him, wondering what could possibly require long sleeves in July in the South.
It's only a couple hours away, he said. An hour and a half if I'm driving.
I'll pack all that if you'll pick out your favorite hats to bring so you don't look like you've newly arrived at boot camp. Rick knew I hated the haircut, but I had to make my point. When we reached the hotel in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a valet swung my door open and took my hand, helping me out of the car.
How are you, ma'am? Welcome to the Reed House.
He lifted and lowered his black hat in salute and turned to Rick, who told me to go inside and he'd join me. I'd never seen a place so beautiful. I walked around, gawking at the towering chandeliers draped with ropes of crystal, and the pearl-studded curtains, the velvet chairs and sofas in the lobby, the bowler-hatted bellmen with their brocade vests. The place had a 1920s vibe that made every woman wish she'd been a flapper. Our room featured the graceful back of one in a giant portrait, seated at a piano, her dress scandalously low-cut, with pearls draped over her shoulder blades. Even the hallway carpet had ropes of gleaming pearls in its design. The Reed House had to be the only hotel in the world that paired USB ports in its guest rooms and constant front desk text communications with a big bank of gleaming, meticulously restored antique wood phone booths in the lobby. Elvis and Oprah and Prince had stayed there. I never wanted to leave. I was lost in a reverie of that weekend when my computer dinged with an email notification on my author account. I ignored it and resumed my daydream, taking advantage of the lightly snoozing residents and my temporary freedom. We'd eaten dinner in the hotel's elegant restaurant that first evening. Our server fussed over us constantly and brought the most delicious dinner of my life, from mini crab cakes to a fork-tender steak to a beautifully plated dessert of roasted strawberries atop brown butter cake with panna cotta and whipped cream. I sipped champagne, and Rick drank a few of their smoked rosemary maple old fashions. He stared into his empty glass and pronounced,
"I'ma need an Uber to our room."
I told him in that hotel, I was pretty sure the staff would carry him on their backs if we asked. Saturday morning, we walked to the riverfront aquarium, where we drank in the air conditioning at the penguin display. Rick pointed.
"You see her? That's Ronnie."
The bird in question had a major wattle issue and had just surrendered her fish to a friend lying on a rock. We also located Rick. That one bopped a smaller penguin on the head with his flipper. We decided Deanna was the one nodding her head at the tourists admiring her extra round body, which could be wearing a black and white polyester pantsuit if you squinted. Kanye strutted back and forth in front of the window, while Kim just stared at her reflection. Rick started assigning tall and short penguins Game of Thrones identities, nodding at a tiny one in the corner.
"I eat fish, and I know things," he said.
I took his arm. "Look, the AC is nice, and we're facing a long walk, but you, sir, must be stopped," I told him. We trudged back in the July sun and collapsed on a sofa in the hotel bar. A margarita and another of Rick's fancy old fashions gave us the energy to get to our little corner of the seventh floor. We spent the rest of the day and night in our room's bed, enjoying each other, along with the champagne and cupcakes the hotel provided. I blushed a little, thinking about it, glancing around to see if anyone was somehow seeing the images in my head, especially the ones involving cupcake icing. Later, we ordered a massive room service dinner, the same aged Wagyu steaks and fried potatoes we'd had the night before, with creme brulee for dessert. Sunday morning, I was instructed to dress in my warm clothes. Rick drove us to Ruby Falls, one of those touristy things I'd seen advertised all my life without paying much attention. We watched a brief intro movie about the guy who'd discovered the falls deep inside Lookout Mountain, his arduous struggle to reach them punctuated by predictable setbacks. He persisted because of his love for his wife. You guessed it, Ruby. About 20 of us rode an elevator 260 feet into the depths of the mountain, then walked a lengthy, chilly path that wound through stalactites and stalagmites and weird rock formations our guide kept pointing out, resembling everything from a turtle to angel's wings. It was dramatically lit and a bit cheesy, but we laughed our way through it. Rick and I stayed close, my hand grasped in his as we made our way. When our group reached the waterfall's chamber, we stood huddled in near darkness until the falls were suddenly illuminated by bright red lights. 145 feet they fell, thundering into a pool of frothing water. It was gorgeous and impressive, far more than I'd expected. We all took turns standing in front of the waterfall for pictures. A sweet lady from California offered to take ours, the one that now decorated my desk.
Our guide, Russell, nattered on about tributaries and the level of magnesium in the pool and 100 more things I didn't hear because Rick had pulled me away from the other tourists and into a dark corner. He kissed me, long and slow. I looked up at him and giggled. "What was that for?" I asked.
"It was because this is the place you're finally going to agree to marry me."
Rick stole a look at the group and placed his hands on either side of my face.
"It was because when you smile, my whole world is full of light. In a dark cave, or at the breakfast table, or sitting next to you on the couch. Because I treasure everything about you. Everything."
He blinked and drew a deep breath.
"Because if I hadn't met you, Ronnie, I'd still be searching for exactly you and only you."
Rick produced a ring box and fell to one knee on the damp cave floor. 21 pairs of eyes were now upon us, ranging from Russell the tour guide to a 10-year-old with his family from India to a quartet of grinning Japanese women in their 20s. Inside the box was an oval ruby surrounded by diamonds, glittering in a tiny built-in spotlight. Rick took the ring out and held it up.
"I am so in love with you, Ronnie. Say yes, and let me put this on your finger. It's cold and wet on these rocks. Have mercy."
I nodded yes, and he kissed me again, in front of a multinational group treated to a little extra excitement on their tour. They all applauded. Russell, the guide, announced he'd known this was going to happen, and Rick had instructed him to leave me behind in the cave if I said no. The group all laughed and came over to congratulate us. Most offered hugs, but the wide-eyed little boy from India solemnly shook my hand and said in heavily accented English,
"I hope you will be very happy, lady woman."
His head bobbed as he enunciated each word.
"I am," I mused, "very happy, lady woman."
In early 2018, my book royalties and Rick's savings had made it possible for us to buy a house in a leafy, upscale neighborhood. Our home had a luxurious kitchen for Rick to cook in, a lovely glassed-in breakfast nook, 2 stories of glossy walnut flooring and plush carpeting, a library that contained too many copies of my own book, a cozy living room fireplace, and a master bedroom balcony overlooking the cerulean pool out back. We talked occasionally about getting married, but we owned a house together, and, as far as I was concerned, things were perfect. The other photo on my desk was from that time, a month or two before he proposed at Ruby Falls, a grinning, shirtless Rick stubbornly pushing a lawnmower in a subdivision where every other family had a weekly lawn maintenance crew. He didn't sense their disdain, or he roundly ignored it. Our wedding was simple. Rick and I were married by the patrol's chaplain at dusk on November 9th, 2018, under a flower arch in the backyard of our home. Caitlin and several of her friends strung lights and matching floral garlands into and between the surrounding oak trees, creating a softly glittering fairyland. We exchanged vows in front of Deanna, Kate, and her new husband, Mark, Rick's best trooper buddy, Brad, and his wife, Nita, and Rick's 2 sons, Josh and Jeremy. They were old enough to be artfully bored and lean on patio furniture, watching the fence gates for their mom to pick them up. I wasn't sorry to see Victoria arrive with their little half-brother and escort them away. Our reception was an extended party during which Rick grilled steaks and everyone consumed a great deal of champagne. Our cake was a triple-tiered red velvet with cream cheese icing, appropriately Southern and accidentally ruby-themed. Well, it was accidental on my part. Rick might have sneaked that past me. Neither of us could take much time off work.
Our honeymoon was 3 days in a king's suite at the Reed House, where we emerged only to cross the street to the City Cafe and eat the best diner food in the world. I worried aloud about all the calories until Rick said the 8 most beautiful words he'd ever uttered to me. You could stand to gain a little weight. I shook my head at all that had unfolded since. Rick was still with the highway patrol, though he was now officially a sergeant. This translated to more money and all the responsibilities he had before, plus some new administrative duties he hated. My royalties had dwindled pretty quickly, and it became clear I had only one book in me, the one Violet gave me. I'd gone back to school for my RN degree and was now where I belonged, with my beloved patients. Unfortunately, my new job also included miles of medical red tape and management duties that kept me desk-tethered too much of the time. I was head nurse, and Caitlin was my director of nursing, occupying Donna's former rose-scented office. These days, it smelled like whatever enticing wax melts Kate had discovered. Last week was lemon pound cake. Today might be vanilla caramel sundae. That office was my happy place during work hours. After my own, Kate still had the second most wicked sense of humor at Fairfield and had welcomed me back there with French fry-scented wax melts and a brown glass wax melter in homage to the late Audrey Marie Ledbetter and her potato vine adventures. My office was the nurse's desk with a dedicated computer for my personal joy. Kate routinely walked by and placed the brown French fry thing in front of my keyboard. I scooted it out of the way and read the email I'd ignored earlier. It was addressed to my public author account. I still had a website, even though only 2 surely lost people visited each month, and Google was determined to bury me. "Dear Mrs. O'Shea," it began, "my dad was the man you called Chet in your book. You called me Eric. It was real sweet of you to change all the names, but everybody knew who my family was. My mama died 3 months ago, and I promised her I'd never contact you, but she won't mind now. See, you made her life a living hell. She wouldn't leave her house after your book, wouldn't even go to church. You made Dad out to be a killer and told the world he was in love with another woman. And you were all wrong. That Violet woman probably even knew what happened between my dad and the doctor you called Tali, and he was a damn hero to do what he did. I can tell you that. And he messed up some things as a kid, but not nearly all you think. That whole pitiful Violet at the train station thing wasn't his doing either. I am asking you to meet with me. You should write about this for your next book. Tell the world you were wrong about Chet, even if it's too late for my mama. Please email me back ASAP. Sincerely, Gary Harris, my real name." I read the email 3 times, and it took a while for me to close my gaping mouth. Gary Harris, son of Chet, I told the real story, whether it pleased you or not. You know what you should write a book about, Gary? Personal boundaries. But what if... I called my husband, who was somewhere beside an interstate, probably eating the lunch I'd missed earlier. "You won't believe this, Rick. A guy claiming to be Chet's son just emailed me. Wants me to clear his daddy's name in a new book. He says Chet did nothing wrong, not even that whole train station thing with Violet. I don't know what to do. I guess I should at least email him back." I heard him rustling in a paper bag, no doubt removing a barbecue sandwich from his favorite old drive-through joint in Heflin. My stomach tumbled a little.
"Well, do you want to write another book?"
he spoke in garble cue. "Of course not. You know that. Especially not with all we have going on."
"Don't answer him, Ronnie. Delete that email right now."
"Aren't you the least bit curious about what he has to say?" I answered.
"No."
I could feel his frown through the phone.
"He's just a crank. A nut? How is our little walnut, by the way?
He or she is the size of a grape, Rick, not a walnut. The baby is fine.
Why is it always food sizes? Why not the approximate length of a AAA battery?
He munched thoughtfully in the background. Because that's weird, Rick. I'm taking good care of the grape. You keep yourself safe and come home to me tonight. And don't forget we're meeting Sam's son Max at Deanna's, her new but ancient brother. She's planning to introduce him to turkey and dressing.
I just got the weirdest bulletin about this virus in China,
Rick segued.
Have you seen anything from the nursing home people?
No, I haven't. It's not a problem here, and it won't be. I love you, Rick.
I love you more, Ronnie. See you about 6.
2. Anniston, Alabama, 1946. Sam stood in the soft red glow, watching as 3 girls materialized before him. Katie Ruth's dark dress appeared first, then Frances, with her auburn hair. The girl in the middle? Ah, she was all light. If Katie Ruth and Frances were candles, Violet was a 100-watt bulb. 3 pretty girls in full profile on a bench after school, the one in the middle with her body leaning 2 feet behind the others, hands holding their shoulders, head thrown back, her blonde hair liquid gold spilling to the ground, looking at the camera like a publicity still starlet, laughing at something Sam had said to amuse her. He couldn't remember what it was. He was always too stunned by Violet's presence to remember much of anything he'd managed to utter. It was a perfect yearbook photo, but Sam wouldn't submit it. This was a gift for his best friend, Johnny. Johnny Perkins walked the halls of Anniston High School with the combined swagger of basketball captain and almost certain valedictorian, a shiny DeSoto to drive occasionally, and the delicate ivory hand of Violet Glenn in his. Sam had this, his passion for photography, indulged by his parents into a ridiculously expensive twin-lens Rolleiflex camera, and a custom darkroom in his enlarged former closet. He had a job working for his dad's department stores, and a bright future assured, whether he accompanied Johnny to college in Tuscaloosa or not. He had a spot on the basketball team and did okay, mostly because Johnny looked out for him. And he had a girlfriend, Deborah. They'd been together almost as long as Violet and Johnny's 2 months. Sam reminded himself of that as he carefully hung the photo to dry, his eyes fixed on the girl in the middle, leaning back as if she could never fall without someone to catch her. Sam didn't hear the doorbell from his dark room upstairs. He didn't see his dad accept a package wrapped in brown paper from the postman, nor did he watch Philip Davidson set it on the kitchen table and stare at it for a moment, checking his wristwatch. Esther wouldn't be home for an hour. Philip Davidson gently took his wife's family heirloom bronze Shabbat lamp from its display shelf. He also grabbed a bottle of bourbon and a cocktail glass, carrying these 3 things to the patio table in the backyard. He returned to the kitchen for the parcel and delivered it to sit beside the bourbon, letting it witness the pouring of a generous slug into his glass. Philip settled into an uncomfortable metal chair and regarded the brown paper before him. Esther would kill him for bringing her precious lamp out here. He glanced at the kitchen window and his son's upstairs, too. Sam was no doubt in his dark room, his sanctuary from all things parental. It had originally been Philip's sanctuary during a brief fascination with photography, but it was Sam's these days with good reason. After a few minutes and several sips, he peeled the package open slowly. He set the paper aside. It would serve as good kindling. Philip put his prize upon the wrought iron table and thought long and hard about what he was about to do. His bourbon glass was empty. He refilled it and took one sip, then carried everything to his new backyard grill. He placed the paper beneath the contents of the package and poured the paraffin oil from the lamp his wife used every Friday evening, dousing every burnable inch before him. He struck a match from his favorite restaurant and tossed it onto the grill, backing away as he felt the heat reach his face. Philip returned to the table and watched the tiny inferno he'd created. The flames shot satisfyingly high. Sipping his drink, he listened for any sound of a witness and heard none. It was the first time he'd smiled in months. Sam took the stairs two at a time, off to basketball practice.
"Dad, I'm going,"
he yelled.
"Johnny's picking me up. I'll be back for supper."
Nothing. His father was probably in the bathroom. Sam preferred to hurry up and leave before his mom got home. She hated his skimpy uniform and would have preferred he play with a trench coat over it. She really was hopelessly old-fashioned. Johnny pulled up to the curb with a grin, granted the rare opportunity to drive his dad's DeSoto to practice. They were usually stuck in Jimmy Lee Clark's rusted pickup truck for these trips, but Johnny's latest report card had earned them the shiny car. Violet's trademark orange blossom cologne greeted Sam as he opened the passenger door. Johnny had driven her somewhere today.
"Here,"
Johnny said, handing Sam a folded white cloth napkin.
"She made tea cakes this morning."
Mrs. Perkins' tea cakes were Sam's favorite thing in the world. He immediately felt bad for failing to grab the photo of Violet he'd meant to give Johnny.
"Amscray before my mom gets home, Johnny. A tea cake before supper is highly illegal in Esterville, and she thinks my uniform looks cheesy. I'm not in the mood to talk about it again."
He turned around to scan the street for Esther's car.
"She just doesn't want you running around looking like a dreamboat, Red."
Johnny laughed.
"You're irresistible in shorts."
He shifted into drive and punched his friend's bicep.
"You know I hate that nickname," Sam answered. "Then lose that hair, buddy. Would you rather I call you Ginger? Actually, I kind of prefer that."
Johnny took off a lot faster than the stately DeSoto was intended to, laughing at his own joke.
"Oh, and by the way, Ginger, we're making a quick stop." "What, to pick up Jimmy Lee?"
Sam said. He noticed Johnny's turn signal indicating otherwise and figured things out pretty quickly.
"I'll only be a second,"
Johnny told him as they parked in front of a small house, its paint peeling in the Alabama sun. Standing alone on the front porch was Violet Glenn, who threw her arms around Johnny and kissed him longer than Sam thought necessary. She then gave Sam a tiny wave and floated gracefully through the screen door, leaving her smile stamped on his stubborn heart.
"This is not Violet's house,"
Sam informed Johnny, feeling stupid for saying it, but unable to conjure anything better.
"No, it's some little kid she babysits. His name is Chet. I think he wants my girl."
Johnny laughed as he turned the ignition key.
"Why would you say that?"
Sam asked.
"Well, Violet told me he has a crush on her, but that's where he's been since we drove up."
He waved his hand low, indicating a not-so-little kid at the front window, staring out.
"I know she told him she needed 1 minute of privacy on the porch, and look what he does."
Johnny nodded toward the house.
"But who wouldn't want her? Right, Ginger?" "Johnny, don't call—" "As you wish, Red. As you wish."
3. Ronnie. February, 2020. Sam's eldest son, Max, began our dinner conversation with,
"We just celebrated my 70th birthday at 11 Madison Park before I flew down here. And Deanna, everything you cooked tastes just as delicious as their food." Even I knew the restaurant's $300-a-plate dinners did not likely include cornbread dressing. Max was a charmer. He passed a platter of sliced turkey to me with a crinkly-eyed grin, and it was one of those old man smiles.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?